Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
There is a lot going on in the case against Karen Reed. The defense is still going as of our recording right here. Might be getting close to resting by the time you watch or see this, but we're going to talk about what has been going on here the first week of June and a little bit of the previous week as the defense is taking the stage in the trial of Karen Reed. There's been a lot of people that have taken the stand. We'll kind of work our way through them. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, joining us. Let's start with behavioral analyzing. I know that's not a word, but it is today.
Word, I like that.
Analyzing. Yeah, like yes, analyzing. Where the defense has been going so far with just kind of a 10,000-foot overview of who they've been presenting, how it's been going, in your opinion thus far. Let's start there.
You know, and you see how I did that? You know, I really thought hard about this last night, Tony. You know, as we do our prep for our show, mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, oh, this is so exhausting. You know, and so then anytime we have an emotion, and because we're deep diving on something, the next thing you got to do is like, if you're having that emotion, other people have been having that emotion. The people I'm thinking are having that same emotion is the jury. Because mm-hmm. that's really, if you think about it, that's really that all that matters right now is that the jury is the one that matters here. And what it looks like, I would imagine from the jury's point of view, but it's so hard because you're not in that courtroom. Mm-hmm. We're only seeing data points that are presented to us and we're watching on TV if we have all that time in the world. But the jury is most likely getting exhausted with the nonstop behavioral attempts to discredit facts with opinions. And that's what I saw a lot of this week, is seeing a lot of facts being that the prosecution presented, and they're attacking it with opinions of others. And so that's kind of a weak attempt to me, but it's exhausting. It is absolutely exhausting. And at a certain point, I know these are smart lawyers, or you're hoping they're smart.
Yeah.
You know, at what point do you stop
dropping
on the heads of the jury?
Yeah.
Because at a certain point, you're going to just piss them off. And they're not going to be on your side at all, no matter what you do.
I think that's like quite a tightrope line that they've been trying to walk here. But yeah. But I don't think that they realize it's a tightrope. I think they feel like it's a very wide path that's been reinforced 35 times, and that the jury is just standing there going, you got this. You are right, no matter what. It feels like they've been drinking the Kool-Aid of the FKR movement, is kind of the vibe I'm getting. Because it doesn't seem that they're very cognizant of how they're presenting to right. the rest of the world. Like, maybe some of the FKR folks are like, And I have seen them online. They're very, they get really riled up when they really think Alan Jackson or Alessi is really just giving it to them. But that's from their, you know, basically their prism of what they're looking at. And I know the other side does the same thing too. But I'm trying to be balanced on this. I feel like one side is a little more living in a fantasy world than the other. I think that's somewhat safe to say when you have to believe so many extreme possibilities all have to line up for the conspiracy of the house beat up story to be true. That seems a lot bigger of a pill to swallow than she was drunk and she accidentally hit her boyfriend. Like, I don't know why this huge mountain of conspiracy seems so much more logical to a large group of people versus just what's very simple and very likely true, even according to the data.
So here's my conjecture and take on it, again, from being 30,000 feet away, is that so the defense looks like to me they're playing the defense of reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what they're poking at. They're not poking at anything but reasonable doubt, because reasonable doubt is what's going to keep her from going to jail.
Yeah.
So they're playing the reasonable doubt, which is an emotional thing you're going for, which, so if you can argue facts and data and with emotions, that's going to really play well into that. And so that's why, and I think the other thing they're doing is kind of what started in the first trial with all the issues with the law enforcement, with the department, with that area, with corruption. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think people are doing, is when people are, especially in that area and online, are so anti-police in this area, which we were too.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of wrongdoings with a lot of things with Proctor and the whole regime there of how they investigated this, mm-hmm. that they held on to, and that became their conclusion that this is all wrong. She's been wrong because this department. Now they're going to have confirmation bias on everything they hear is going to support that. And that's where the emotions come in, and rather than the pragmatic, objective approach to, hey, here's the actual data and evidence as presented by the accident scene reconstructionist, which actually went data points, science, engineering behind how these mm-hmm. things could actually happen. And then they're emotionally arguing them. And so that's what I think they're doing. They're literally hitting the lower brain of emotional reaction to the things to get the reasonable doubt going, which is going to keep her from being convicted.
Well, that's their goal anyway. We'll see if that works, because it's very, I feel like it's very different this round. I feel like we really have, mm-hmm. and I always do my thing, like, for whatever reason, this hand is Karen Reed's consciousness. This is always, I'm always holding it up. But the thing is with Karen Reed on this one, it's the data is there. It's so much better than it was the last round, where we 100%. Have the phone turning off, or we have the vehicle doing the turn. And yes, I know that type of data that pulls from that vehicle doesn't show a strike, but it wouldn't show a strike because it's not capable of showing a strike. What it is capable of doing is turning on, basically recording 5 seconds before an event and five seconds after an event, and it shows weird things with the vehicle, things that would trigger it, like sudden acceleration to very extreme lengths, which is basically what triggered it. And then when you match all that up with the phone data, it's there. I mean, it doesn't take rocket science to figure this out. I mean, this is like movie of the week back when there was movie of the week. Oh, look, there's broken taillight. There's a dead body. Her car has a broken taillight. That used to be enough to convict. Like, that would have been like all
and
of
I'm,
it.
And so I'm even taking the taillight out of this entire thing, because that's
take
so
that out. Yeah. Yeah.
So here's the things that I think are really solid on data.
Mm-hmm.
And that is medical examiner head strike to the back of the head.
Yep.
That's solid. That's what caused the death, you know, from which is a hypothetical of a slip and a fall outside on ice or whatever it was, right? Mm-hmm. So that's really, really solid to me. The other solidness is the accident reconstructionist about the bruising on the body that matches the positions of her car, you know, like elevations, that whole thing, the reconstruction of where that bruising on his body could actually come from, where he could then fall backwards and hit the back of the head. That is what is so solid to me. And then what was presented this week, which I thought was, again, it's a data point that they're just emotionally arguing, no dog DNA.
Yeah.
That was really, really good. It's like, boy, I hadn't really thought about that one before. We examined the behavior of dog and things like that in the past, behavior of people in the house. But hey, if they're claiming he was, you know, he was bit or attacked by the dog, where's the dog DNA on him?
Yeah.
That was a good one.
Well, very, very much. I mean, we're talking about if you're attacked by a dog, excuse me, I had a cough there. Yeah, you're going to have fibers. You're going to have fur. They're going to have DNA. And when we go back to the Marie Russell testimony, that was very, I guess, telling to a certain extent. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Telling to a certain extent of just when someone wants to be heard and they think their voice is very valuable, they'll make it heard. And Marie Russell is someone who claimed in her testimony, she had no interest in the case, but she's the one who raised her hand and volunteered saying, I know dog bites, even though there is no practice in dog bite identification. It doesn't exist. There's not a lot of literature on it. There's not a lot of studies on it, but she has her credentials of working in an ER for many years. Okay. I mean, the last time she was there, I believe it was like Bush one was president, but it's very, it was interesting to see her confidence versus accuracy. Because she's very confident in what she's saying, but accurate when really, you know, when push comes to shove and it's not just her spouting off the groups that she's a part of, that a lot of them have nothing to do with this type of evidence, she really kind of fell flat.
And so here's what I'd like to see now, because they raised to me that was an interesting question, because now here's something that can move out of the realm of an opinion like hers and a topic that's brought up and then they tried, you know, getting rid of it, you know, striking it, that defense because they didn't like it, but it was just on cross. Then let's actually, that's why they didn't do this. I would like to now know other situations where people have been attacked by dogs. Is there dog DNA left behind? Like they did this with the accident reconstruction. He showed in the past, you know, that here's how it's reconstructed. Here's the impact on bodies. Here's the engineering behind it. Here's the force times momentum. You know, here's how that whole thing works. You know, from not just this accident, but other accidents, right? So now we have a baseline of comparison.
Yeah.
All right. Dog DNA. I want to see it. I want to see other dog bite attack. Because to me, my conjecture and hypothesis is, it would make sense that there should be dog DNA left behind if a dog is involved in attack on a human.
You would think that data exists.
Yeah. So let's look at it. Let's get some data and facts so we can get out of the realm, because I don't believe anyone's opinion in this entire case, because they're all drunk. They all have confirmation biases. The only thing I want is every time I can get a little bit of a scientific fact and data, that's what I want, because that's where I would imagine, because I'm just trying to place myself in the seat of the jury, of a jurist, you know, when there's so many people's opinions, it just becomes white noise, you know, and in order to get through the noise, if I need to do the best I can to give my opinion and my verdict and my vote on acquittal or guilty, you know, I want to really, and their instructions is going to be data.
Yeah.
So,
well, I'd also
think that's what I want to see.
Another big point about the dog bite attack here in the trial of Karen Reed. How many dog bites happen and clawing happens where there's no puncture at all? If that were supposed to be multiple strikes of a dog, which would require basically, you know, the jaw to like, and the teeth to realign itself every time it's going at you, like in getting closer, smaller, it doesn't make sense. But if it's a paw, I mean, maybe a little, but I guess it's like a three clawed dog or something. I don't know. And it has no bottom jaw or saliva.
You would think if the defense is going to use that as a plausible theory as to what had happened, that they would have done a deeper dive to explain how that could have happened rather than just a conspiracy theory that's what happened.
Yeah.
And if they didn't do that, because maybe there's nothing there they could do that with. I'm disappointed is that prosecution then didn't do a deeper dive refuting the entire stupid theory.
Yeah, no, I agree. What I'm surprised by in this is that they just had somebody raise their hand and say, I know this stuff. And they took a bit of a look at her and went, oh, okay, she's really good. And didn't really go much deeper. It feels like they didn't vet her very well. The defense. And it's like anybody who felt like they had a good thing to say about this, They just took him in and said, yes, you're part of the case now, including a blogger who likes to run around and harass people and say horrible things. Like, come on in. You're part of, like, there wasn't turning many people down. And I'm wondering if that is because it was very difficult to find anybody to come in that would have some sort of expertise that would work in their favor if all they could really end up with was those folks who were like, I want to talk out loud and say what I think. Sure, come on in. Let's hope it works.
But let's go back to the. Yeah. Well, I think the important thing to then do is go back to the first case where they did all this.
Yeah.
The first case was a lot more solid because the appearance of malfeasance by the proctor and the entire department was much greater.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seemed to me, because like you and I both were like, dude, she's innocent because this department was completely corrupt.
Yeah.
Regardless, I didn't think of any conspiracy theory, but I thought that, you know, that was. She was wrong because of them.
Yeah.
But what they did was they gave the prosecution a lot more time to fix that by eliminating and mitigating all those weak points of that department and shoring up their data of the reconstruction of the accident and all these other things. And then she didn't help herself by creating a Netflix interview herself and everything else where you saw where we got a deeper dive and all the people actually behind this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, remember during the first trial, Proctor and that whole department was much more front and center.
Yeah, they're barely on the stage.
Yeah. And so this time it's not.
Yeah.
This time it's actually been kind of brushed aside. And so the defense first time was relying on that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to do a deeper dive. And so if they're just going to bring the same case forward, or the same defense forward from the last time to this time, not thinking it's going to be anything great difference. That's why I think we got what we have now.
Well, and they're not even doing the same defense as the last time. They're not calling Proctor, at least as far as we know yet. They had his friend up on the stand who really didn't want to be there the other day,
right,
reading those texts, or he even's like, I'm uncomfortable. So then we have Brennan reading the texts, and it was just not the moment at all that it used to be. I mean, in the first trial, it was dramatic. It was, oh my gosh, this is horrible. And maybe we'll see the text have another life in this. I don't know. But it didn't land well. The jury doesn't have the perspective, I think, that they wanted them to have on Proctor. They're not feeling the abhorrent way that he was speaking. And they're not feeling, I think, the gravity of what they tried to bring to the first one. Plus, they've already been prepped and they've already been exposed to so much of Karen and her abhorrent behavior that when it came time for Proctor to say she's a no-ass bitch in the texts, people were like, well, it seems like she's said a lot of worse things over here, or not even worse things, but her actions have been more deplorable than a guy saying stupid things to other guys. And it's not to dismiss what Proctor said. I'm just saying actions, sometimes speak louder than words, and the actions that Karen has taken since the crime, since the accident or whatever you want to call it, have been a little bit more disturbing. The way that she's basically, it seems that she has knowledge of this and was completely okay with getting behind, harassing all these people, ruining all of these lives, all because she just didn't want to take responsibility for an accident. And that's a hell of a lot worse than a guy saying bad words about you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when no one's likable, you need facts and data. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think all this other noise that they're creating in defense right now is no facts and data. It's just opinions. Yeah. And everyone's so sick of it because no one's likable here. There's no one that's likable. I mean, can you imagine trying to want? I mean, again, it kind of goes to the statement I made last time. Mm-hmm. So regardless of whether she's found innocent or guilty, the fact that so many people think she could have done this, that you could have actually hit someone, killed him, or at least mortally wounded him and then drove away, that you could have done that, you as a human being, that so many people think you could have done that. You now have to, I mean, think about it. You have to live with the fact that someone thinks you're that kind of human being the rest of your life.
Yeah. Cause at the end of the day, this isn't going to change whatever the jury decides. It's not going to change opinions. I think for the most part, if you're really diehard Karen at this point, you're going to continue being diehard. There's nothing that's going to change your mind.
Absolutely.
But if you have been able to look at this objectively throughout the whole time, minds have been swayed. Mine has been swayed. I was trying to write it in the middle. I really did thought, well, maybe she did it, but there's not enough evidence to prove it. There's enough evidence to prove it now. And by her own admission, I think it's second degree.
And this is the fun part with me, because you said there's enough evidence to prove it. Okay. I'm still every week, though. I'm the pendulum back and forth.
Yeah, but
I base this every week on, this is a good week for defense or a good week for prosecution based on the impact of what's presented that week, because people have short-term memory loss.
Oh, completely. That's going to be the problem.
So at this point, to me, I think right now, because defense is on front and center, it's edging towards a defense right now again, because people have short-term memories. That's why at this point, it's really going to be important, super critical for closing arguments of the prosecution to bring up those facts and data points to get away from the emotional responses that people are having to what's being presented this week, because people are extremely responsive to those compelling emotional stories and this is the thing I thought of too. When you lack a lot of facts and data, as both sides pretty much are, although I think the prosecution has much more than defense, it really relies 100% on the person presenting them in the courtroom.
Yes.
And if you have a compelling personality doing it, then, you know, like you said, you know, the evidence might be supporting one side or the other, but if the person presenting is more compelling on the other side, it makes a huge impact on emotional people that are sitting on a jury.
Likability is so important in this, as it was it's bigger even than the data on all of this.
You know, they coach us stuff. I mean, you know, a lot of times when it's like, I got friends that are, you know, FBI experts as well, you know, that are nonverbal experts that do courtroom coaching. Not for what to say, but how to look, how to present, what kind of suit to wear, what kind of jacket to wear, you know, 3-button versus 2-button, what kind of collar to wear. I mean, there is so much nuance between how to present yourself, how to speak in the courtroom, the tenor, the intonation, the tempo, all these things you're going to do regardless of the facts and data you're presenting, because that is what the jury is watching. That is what the jury is paying attention to, is not just the what, but the who is delivering it. That's why I'm still watching this pendulum swinging like this, because I'm with you. Facts and data, prosecution has a lot of facts and data. Yeah. They're outweighing it. But it really, can you imagine, if the defense was better likable as well, they'd be doing better.
I completely agree. And likability being a huge thing in this trial, the trial of Karen Reed. They all know how important it is. Brennan's coming across a certain way. I know, like, if you're an FKR hardcore person, you don't like him. If you're kind of middle of the road, I think you do kind of like him, because he is very fact-based. He has a bit of humor to him, which I'm enjoying. And at first I thought he was kind of boring. Then I'm like, oh my God, he's really funny. Because when he goes on his things, he reminds me of just like a stream of consciousness talking out loud, where he'll put little comments in there, little digs almost that you have to kind of catch, and like, ooh, there's a little Easter egg. And it's funny. Some of it's somewhat probably inappropriate if he was delivering it differently, but he gets these little comments in there. But he is very factual with his approach.
And let me, if I could include one thing in what you just said on that too, and the fact that he can do that, only people that can do that actually have depth of field of things they're talking about because they know their content so well, they can maneuver with that content and own that content, and they know exactly how to deliver that content. And so that goes towards credibility huge. When you know your background, when you have such depth of field of what you're presenting so well that you give that persona off that you're living it, that goes a huge towards credibility towards the jury and everyone else. Because look how it impacted you. Yeah. Look how it's impacting everyone.
Yeah.
It shows a lot about the credibility.
It feels like he's coming in with having done his homework, and it honestly feels like the defense of Karen Reed are kind of phoning it in sometimes. Where we're just exhausted.
Don't you get the impression that they're chasing
them? They are. And that's what I'm curious to get your take on, is after all these days with them on doing their part on the defense, they're not coming across as likable at all. And if your defendant that you are representing already isn't likable, you got to really turn it up. You got to like make up for all of that unlikability over here. And it feels like they're really coming across as unlikable. They're coming across as, you know, just disrespectful to witnesses. They're coming across as disrespectful to victims in this case. They're coming across as almost insulting the jury, I feel like, at times, and their intelligence, that the jury wouldn't see the tactics that they're trying to employ to basically trip someone up. Once you get it to say this way, we're going to spend like 3 hours of me just trying to argue over this little point and try and get you to say it one way. People are seeing through that, I would think.
Yeah, yeah.
And it feels like someone's being taken advantage of. It feels very used car salesman-like out of 1988. It's not attractive. It's not likable. How do you think the jury is reading the defense thus far?
Exhausting. I mean, because it's obvious what they're doing and what they're attempting to do and what they're doing to these people. And also, again, to me, it looks like they are chasing the prosecution. And when you're chasing someone, it means you're on defense.
Yeah.
Granted, they are on defense, but when you are that much on defense, they're only reacting to everything the prosecution has done. And even the lines of questioning that they're going down, they keep ending in dead ends. Like you could tell the point they're hoping to get to, mm-hmm. but they lack the skill or ability, or it just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And so every time it happens, they lose even more credibility. And then when they lose that, they feel the sense in the energy in the room has shifted away from them. And that makes them more frustrated. When you get more frustrated, you get more emotional. When you get more emotional, you become less likable.
Yeah.
And so it plays well. But again, if you have a confirmation bias that is pro Karen, then what it does is it reinforces that we're the victim. We're being persecuted. That, so see what I mean? It's helping if you're living in the echo chamber of pro Karen.
Yeah.
And it's not if you're not. And so what it really comes down to is, I wonder what the jury, if anyone was preconceived before they went in there. If they do, you're not swaying any opinions, but if they're open-minded, I think they're not helping themselves.
And that's the thing, where if you have one person in there that was already pro Karen and is still super diehard, you could get another hung jury here. I'd be shocked if you get, honestly, I think it's going to be either guilty on one or all of the charges or hung jury. I don't think you're going to get a complete acquittal on any of this, or not guilty.
I don't think we're going to get a hung jury on this one.
No?
I think it's been better. My fingers crossed. I just think this one went smoother. I think it went better, at least on the prosecution side.
Yeah.
And I think it was clear what the prosecution was attempting to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought they were more solid on the evidence they presented, because we got out of I think everyone got exhausted by the lunacy of trying to get drunk people to give testimony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just everyone gave up on that. It just makes no sense.
And when you had Judson Welcher taking the stand, from Aperture, he laid it out very well. They went and bought another Cadillac, or Lexus rather. And the test that he did, he had the receipts for. He showed exactly how he did all of it. And, yep. And it seems like they want to jump on some of the, you know, what they would consider, like, I guess if you're not part of accident reconstruction, some things may look a little silly to you, but guess what? You know, behind the curtain, this is how some things do get done. They want to pick at the paint, the blue paint on the arm, which really truly made sense when you looked at how that vehicle came up and they did it at 2 miles an hour. Oh, this all really truly does fit. That was kind of shocking. And I'm kind of amazed it took 3 years for someone to do this and show it publicly. I mean, right. The first thing in my mind was, well, can we get one of those vehicles and just put somebody next to it of the same height and stature and see where these body parts line up? My thought was that, well, they must have already done this and maybe it just didn't look good for either side or whatnot. No, it just hasn't been done. If I would have known that, I would have gone to the Lexus dealership. It's just, can I stand by this car for a few minutes and see how this works out? But it was shocking to see that. And then just the data itself. He brought so many big facts to the case. And honestly, not a lot of emotion. It was just facts. He was just there to argue his facts. He was an engineer, and an engineer all the way he was. And that really seemed to to get under the skin of the defense, because they're writing, making this an emotional case, and they were dealing with an engineer that's not dealing with emotions at all. How do you think
an
his
engineer
testimony,
that's got reps in the courtroom?
Yes, exactly. And it's, he's not basing people's work.
I mean, when listening to him in the courtroom, his, granted, I'm not knocking defense because mm-hmm. they're in a tough position, you know, because I'm not a lawyer in that job.
Yeah.
He seemed to have more time in the courtroom than the defense attorney did.
Yeah.
He was more fluid, more solid, more confident, more mm-hmm. transparent.
Yeah.
I love it when, because again, I look for the behaviors of trust,
mm-hmm.
open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability. The vulnerability factor saying, if something doesn't fit, you don't make an excuse trying to say it does fit. In other words, you're not saying it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where we have a flaw, because this is what engineers do. This is what scientists do.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, here's our experiment we conducted. Here's an anomaly that doesn't quite fit, like the taillight with the fragments of the taillight. Mm-hmm. This doesn't quite fit, but here's all the data points that do that says, hey, I'm not trying to hide anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to inflate anything. Here's the past data from other accident reconstructions I've done. Here's how it fits here. I loved how every time defense came in and said, well, you know, well, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, well, show it to me on a slide. All right, let me look at this. I mean, he's actually going back to all the data,
mm-hmm.
you know, restating to him exactly what the data was, what the slide was. I mean, it was really thorough. If you don't have, in other words, that was a 50-pound brain of the accident reconstructionist going against what felt like in the moment, a 20 or 30-pound brain of the defense attorney.
It reminded me of like a child or a kid like in high school who didn't do their homework, and now they're trying to to participate in like a group pop quiz or something. And so it's in public. It's not just on the paper. And they're trying to like argue their point. They didn't read the book, but they're going to try and argue some point of the book that doesn't even exist, because maybe it could exist, but it's really not in the book because everybody else read the book, but I'm going to keep pushing this. And wouldn't it be a great narrative if it was? Sure, but it's not for 3 hours.
Great analogy. So to me, it's like, so the defense attorney felt like he read the cliff notes and he's arguing with the author who wrote the book.
Yes, very much so. That is how it felt. And then when they got their other expert in there the other day, Matthew DeSorga, me and Coffendaffer kept calling him DiGiorno because we couldn't think of his name. Like, it's not pizza, it's not delivery, it's DiGiorno. But DeSorga, obviously he was in there. He didn't do any research. He just looked at the research of the others and said, well, I guess here's what I think, which for the most part matched up with what the other guys thought, but he had his opinion on the timeline a little bit. The timeline has been an interesting thing to me in this case of Karen Reed, because I was driving back from Kansas this weekend and it was a 4-hour drive and all I listened to was Friday's testimony as I'm driving through nothing but flat land. So it was the most thrilling drive I've ever had in my life, listening to them argue about basically a 30-second piece of time for 4 hours. And it just was kind of stunning to me, because when you take a step back and you go, okay, we're like literally trying to get down to like a little 3-second mark here, or like an on the second mark. But at the end of the day, the window is about 30 seconds. Let's say we didn't have all this data that we do anymore, as detailed as it is, or we can get it down to literally the second. Let's say all we had was a 30-second window. That should be enough to convict as well, because if we're talking about a 30-second window of one piece of data showing that the vehicle, something happens, and then his phone stops working, and we do have drift on clocks here, even if we didn't have to try and figure out the drift on the clock, one can reasonably say it's within 30 seconds, even if the clocks are all off by a little bit. It very likely shows that she struck him. There's nothing else that could have possibly happened to him. That's what happened. 10 years ago, that would have just been, oh my gosh, this is just, you know, hard, amazing, look at this fact. Now, because it's like, well, we think the clock is a little different this way, but we think it's this different over here. We're still talking about the same 30 seconds. And at the end of the day, it still shows the same damn thing.
It's again, I just see it from the optic of, you know, hey, let's pay attention to this timeline to create the reasonable doubt. So we're, mm-hmm. don't pay attention to the accident reconstructionist who actually shows how that vehicle actually could have hit his body in exactly the same spot, and the blow to the black head killed him when he fell backwards.
Yeah.
So let's pay attention to timeline instead. Like you said, screw it, get rid of the
timeline. And there's nothing wrong with the timeline either.
The timeline.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm looking at the accident reconstructionist, blow to the back of the head, and now if we want to throw in some lack of dog DNA to kind of befuddle your inside, you know, dog attack, you know, conspiracy theory, that's why it's to me, it's all these things are noise to distract from the actual hard fact from a scientist that you have. Again, that's purely me.
Yeah.
And you're saying, as you're saying, driving back and listening to this drone on for hours and hours and hours, that's when I hit the same, you know, hey, place yourself in that jury's box.
Yeah.
Or you're probably thinking exactly the same thing. Oh my God, shut up. Can we get on with this thing? Let me vote now because you people are driving me up a wall.
Yeah.
That's what defense has to be careful of, mm-hmm. is that when you start, you know, I mean, I really wonder if they have loving critics in there saying, hey, here, you know, their job, and I know they do, their job is completely watch the jury and their response to what you're doing it. And we do this all the time as human beings. You can tell when you're born to live in hell out of someone, it's time to move on.
They don't have any loving critics.
I wonder if they have this. I don't, because we don't see the jury in there. And that's always the big thing in these cases. You and I and all the us talking heads, we paid so much attention to what's being presented. The only thing that always matters is how it's being received by the jury.
The defense of Karen Reed, in my opinion, they have loving proponents. They don't have loving critics. And if you only have proponents, you're just going to believe whatever your circle tells you. If they're saying, you did great today. And that's what I feel like, they should be doing better than this. These attorneys shouldn't just be sitting here going, my client can do no wrong. You should be looking at the whole damn thing. Not that you're going to try and convict your client, but have an idea of how this is playing out there to the public, to your jurors, so you don't keep playing it the wrong way to these people who think you can do no wrong, because these people over here that matter, they think you can do wrong, and they think you're probably doing a lot of wrong, according to a lot of the reactions that we've been hearing out of the courtroom, of seeing the jurors' reactions. They're paying close attention to all of this, and they are reacting in negative ways a lot to the defense when things seem like a bit fishy.
The last thing they should be doing as both a prosecution and defense is paying attention to your supporters.
Yeah, exactly.
The only people you should be paying attention to are the people who think you're off.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be your greatest insights on how you need to adjust.
Yeah.
Or what you're not covering or your blind spots. Because again, the most important thing you're doing because this is a battle.
Yeah.
You know, most important thing you do in any battle, whether it's a virtual battle, whether it's a physical battle or a courtroom battle, is you have to understand what your blind spots are. And the only way you understand what your blind spots are is see what the enemy sees. Sure. You know, and your adversaries, what are they saying? What are they seeing? What's their critiques of you? Because that's what you really need to be adjusting to. Because if you look at online right now, this case in public opinion is still 50-50. And I know you got one side screaming louder than the other when it comes to Karen Reed supporters. But when you do the analysis, this case is still 50-50 from public opinion.
Yeah.
Well, you don't know what the jury thinks, but you can hypothesize that it's probably very much the same.
And I would wonder.
If you want to sway it beyond the 50-50, you got to pay attention to what your adversaries are saying.
I'd be interested because they do not have access to all the same stuff we have. They haven't seen all the conjecture, you know, supposedly. Or just how dark things have gotten, you know, with the blogger and all of that stuff. Another point here that happened recently, the testimony of Kelly Dever. I know I'm screwing up her name and I should know it. I know the defense attorneys messed it up too. But I'm going to say Dever. She was the former Canton police officer who originally gave a report saying that she had seen Brian Higgins and Berkowitz in the Sallyport with Reed's car. Then, a little bit after, timestamps showed that she couldn't have because she was already either gone for the day or not there yet. It was one of the two. I forget which one. But physically, it would have been impossible for this event to have ever taken place. So it's a false memory. Now, in a case that is living on conspiracy, on a case that is
and false memories
and is fraught with all sorts of just nothing can be easy here. Nothing can just be straightforward of, I saw this, here's what it is. Now we're introducing false memory into the testimony. And at the end of the day, I know she played very well, actually, for the prosecution, despite being a defense witness, because she called out Alan Jackson for his behavior, basically demanding, allegedly, that she testify one specific way. And if she did not, she claims that he threatened that he'd find a way to charge her with perjury. She calls the FBI and gets... has some sort of conversation there about, would this be perjury? If I'm saying this right now, I didn't, it was clearly I was wrong. And that's how that gets cleared up. It all doesn't look good. None of it looks great. The testimony that I think won the day was that of Alan Jackson trying to intimidate a witness is what, you know, allegedly is what seemed to win that. But I'm sorry, it does not look good that you have a false memory over a pretty key piece of evidence here, or witness testimony in this case. I mean, what did you make of that and how that played out altogether?
Yeah, I like that she called the FBI and that she made an effort, which, so when I've worked with really good people and some people that weren't so good. And the ones that are really good are the ones that are doing their utmost to actually uphold the standard of law.
Sure.
And to be righteous in the things they're doing. And so when you think you might have done something wrong, you double check in what you did. So I like that when it comes to credibility. But when it comes to false memories, yeah, this whole thing is false memories. But again, did not ring 12 good for Alan Jackson whatsoever. Because again, And this is what people really got to watch so often in life. And I think this is what might have happened here. In his impression, he wasn't intimidating anyone. Mm-hmm. He might be thinking, I'm merely stating a fact that you could self-perjure yourself if you did X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
But now he didn't know how it felt on the other side because he lacked empathy to see how it's received. Because now from the receiver it could be, I was just threatened.
Yeah. And now it looks like this to a jury.
Yes.
And it's, had that line not been ever said, if he had never said anything allegedly about, you know, this could be perjury or I'm going to get you charged with whatever the hell he said, had that just been left out and he just challenged her on the stand of, didn't you say this once? Yes, but I did it. And all of the vitriol, all of the rage that she seemed to have for Alan Jackson would have been left out. It just would have been, you're catching someone who is claiming they have a false memory, claiming they did everything that they could to write it, but all the negative of Alan Jackson wouldn't be in that. It's the negative of Alan Jackson that totally turned that witness that could have been a big pro for the defense, for a big pro for the prosecution, because it would have looked like, false memory? Really? You have a false memory of these two people? And even I'm like, really? You have a false memory of these two people? Like, you get really specific in your false memory there. It's not just, I saw the car in the garage. I could see that being a false memory. Cars come and go from there all the time, I'm sure. And if you're not really a big part of the case and you're just like, yeah, it was there, sure. You know, and you're like, oh, wait, it couldn't have been. There must have been some other car. Okay, I get that. But you're like, these two very specific people were in there talking and what are you remembering?
And really show once again just how unlikable Alan Jackson
yes,
is.
Yes, exactly. It does. It really and does. And
that's, so again, it's just another data point for the jury to get. It's like, dude, this guy is just an unlikable guy. And so if you start getting your own, so again, confirmation bias as human beings is so powerful. So now if you didn't like how he, and this is also why prosecution has been very just facts and data, mm-hmm. because when you start playing on people's emotions, and you start trying to use that as a lever, mm-hmm. You're going to win some people and you're going to lose some people. And the people and both sides now are going to have confirmation bias. If they like what Alan Jackson did, well, then everything he says is going to be gold. Mm-hmm. If you don't, then everything he says from that point is completely flushed out.
Yeah.
That's why you are really playing with fire with a human being when you start playing that emotional card. Because unless you're really, really good, charismatic, and compelling, like very few people are, where you can win everyone over, mm-hmm. you're going to lose at least some. And that's not good for you.
And it felt like when these things erupt, they're not, Alan Jackson didn't have very good self-control. Alessi has not had very good self-control in this either. Where, okay, you're met with some things you're not expecting. Don't go into a rage at the person. because that seems to be what's happening. It's like, you got to play it cool here if you want to be likable. Now it looks like you're harassing this young woman, this young cop, who clearly is a bit green, but clearly has, you know, a badass attitude. but it looks like you're attacking her personally. She had to call the damn FBI on you. Is like, you're being accused of having a witness call the FBI on you in your trial. That's not a good look. Calm down. Yes. Because this is not playing well to a jury at all, at least in my opinion.
It's a behavior arc for them.
Yeah.
And so remember, if you get 1, 2, 3 data points of someone behaving that way, it can now be assumed that that's the way they interact with everyone.
And it's surprising. I mean, these are well-respected attorneys. I'm wondering, I mean, everybody is human here in this. And that's what we have to remember, I think, because sometimes you think, well, you're the attorney. They got to have all these superpowers. They've been doing this case now for almost 3 years or so. I mean, some a little bit less. And dealing with Karen Reed, every time they turn a corner, every time they think they're making a really good point, they're met with Karen Reed shooting them basically in the head. I'm not going to say even the foot. She's aiming directly for a kill shot, it seems, almost every time. Her own defense. Because every clip that gets played and undermines everything that they just made a point on with her own words. That's got to be a bit defeating. That's got to be frustrating as heck when this is a person you're trying to defend and all they seem to keep doing is every, you know, 5 feet of advancement you make, they're pulling you back 10.
And it's a shame, like, again, I think in the last couple of weeks, she herself has been better. And because I'm not hearing about her, which means she's better. So it's too bad that person, again, when you just to your point about what defense has to deal with, they're still dealing with who she was a year ago and doing Netflix in the present. And it's too bad that they couldn't keep her from doing those things and have her behave like she is now. Because again, I'm not in the courtroom, not watching every day because that's why I'm so sympathetic to the jurists that I have to do this every day. You know, I'm getting clips and I'm getting blurps. I'm doing like an hour here, an hour there. But I do see her. Now, again, I try to be as objective as possible. I think she's been better in the last week or two than she's been before because she hasn't opened her mouth as much. She's not making looks. I don't think she's great, but she's not bad. I mean, she set a really low bar for behavior that she needs to have. But you're right. So, but you know, her history keeps coming back and haunting her really bad. I'm sorry, I got a cold.
I mean, not that the jury is seeing it, but I mean, when she's walking out of court, she's still saying stuff. And that's where, again, I don't.
But it's not making headlines the same way as it was because, again, it became part of her baseline.
I feel like it is. It's part of the baseline and it's burnout. And that's what I'm wondering is what's going on with the attorneys. Are they just getting burned out? Are they like, we're going to do our damn best job, but, you know, what could have been our best job up here is now going to have to be here, not because they don't want to or they can't get there, but because no matter what they do, they can't get there. They're not capable of it because she'd pulled them all down so far that they could have been operating at that level, but you just can't if there's not the supports to be there because she kicked them all out.
It's also really interesting, too, when you look at the behavior of Jackson and the whole defense, what appears to be from presentation, a lack of confidence in what they're doing and a desperation this feeling that they're chasing the prosecution's, you know, great strategy and what they're doing. You know, the only reason you'd have that behavior is because they don't think they're doing well.
Yeah.
Which is interesting to me because when you look at public opinion on Twitter and the pro Karen Reed people, again, most people, and when I do the deep dive on ChatGPT, it's saying, hey, this case is still 50-50. Yeah, when you look at the behavior of defense, I don't get the sense from their standpoint that they think that. When you're in chase mode, when you're in, it looks to be in desperate mode, I think they're seeing things that the rest of the world's not seeing when it comes to this. So it's...
Yeah. I don't know that they... Do you think the defense feels that they're in desperate mode, or do you think that they're presenting a really strong case? If they're looking at it objectively, I can't imagine they think it's going well.
Boy, it's so hard to tell whether, again, who are they paying attention to?
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah.
You know, if they're listening to only their echo chamber, they're doing rock star stuff. Mm-hmm. But if they're objective and taking in all the people talking heads like you and me, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of others out there saying the same things, like, dude, no way, this ain't going well. So you just don't know what they're doing. And that's why it's a really complicated case. And that's why the only thing that matters is those 12 people.
She should have just listened to David Yannetti to begin with. He's the only one on that team that I feel good about, that I'm like, I like him. He seems like he's probably a decent guy. Because he's the one who initially was like, well, yeah, if you did do this, because she went to him and said, well, what if I did hit him? Then you have some comfortability. Didn't like that. Well, we better bring in the other attorney that's going to tell you a bunch of other stuff once the mysterious man comes right to us and says, look at the people in the house. Yannetti would have, you know, they probably would be, she'd be free. This would all be said and done by now. You know, she'd probably have to do a little bit of time back then, but that'd be over. And there'd probably be some fines and that sort of such, probation maybe.
And the damage to your brand, you know, the reputation of who you are as a human being.
You've ruined your life now. Yeah.
Yeah. It just wouldn't nearly be as catastrophic.
Cause she could have come back from, I think, pretty easily professionally and all that. It wouldn't have been this big spectacle. No, we wouldn't even know about the damn thing. It would have been a small local story.
Drunk tragedies and horrendous things like this do happen from time to time.
They do. Yeah,
too many times, you know, and you have two parents and a family that lost their son. And that, again, always is at the bottom line of everything, is that, you know, justice needs to be served.
Yeah.
But, man, everyone could have made it so much easier on themselves and the legacy that they're leaving behind than this nightmare.
Yeah, I don't think anyone could have done it any worse than they have.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody. Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.